17 seconds and counting. Guidance internal. 15, 14, 13, 12, 11, 10, 9. We have ignition sequence start. Engines on. 5, 4, 3, 2.
Today, my guest is NASA astronaut Dr. Jerry Ross. He's a veteran of a record 7 space shuttle flights, has performed 9 spacewalks, is an author, has orbited the Earth almost 1,000 times, and has recently been inducted to the Astronaut Hall of Fame. Dr. Ross, thanks for being with us today.
It's good to join you, Andy. Thank you for having me on.
1,000 orbits around the Earth. That's a few more than John Glenn had in Friendship 7.
Yeah, but he did it very early in the program, and he, as you might remember, he had a very exciting flight with the erroneous indications on his heat shield.
He sure did, and I remember that like it was yesterday.
I do, too. Yeah, I talk about in my book, in fact, my mother allowing me to play hooky from school so I could stay home and watch that very historic flight.
Yes, I recall the same thing, and then I used my father's 56 Dodge as a Mercury capsule for a while. How does a young boy growing up in a rural town in Indiana, before the word astronaut was even a word, become an astronaut and fly 7 space shuttle missions?
Well, I really feel like there was divine help in all that, Andy. I know it sounds a little bit corny to say maybe, but there were so many circumstances and setbacks and a car accident that my wife had and all kinds of things that all played a part in my eventually weeding through all these windows of opportunity and getting a chance to be selected into the astronaut office. It's just an incredible series of events that I discuss many of them in the book that most people, I think, would take them as indications that they ought to stop and go do something else with their lives. And I was a fairly determined young lad that that's what I was supposed to do, and I was going to do whatever I could to get there eventually.
You've been on classified defense missions, deployed satellites and space observatories, performed science experiments and spacewalks to build the International Space Station. Do you have a favorite mission of all your missions?
You must be about the millionth person to ask me that question, and I've come up with the answer that I think most people would understand, and that is that question is like asking a mother which of her 7 children is her favorite. I mean, each one has very special attributes. Some of them were more fun than others, but certainly all of them were challenging and very rewarding flights. If I'm forced to pick one as my favorite, I guess I will normally go with my very first one just because it was a first one, and I did get to have 2 spacewalks on that flight, and everything on it went very successfully. We launched 3 communication satellites that went off to do very good work for many, many years, and so, and the crew I flew with was a lot of fun to be with as well. So the first one is always going to have a very special place, but all of the others were very rewarding flights as well.
Can you tell us a little bit about liftoff, the feeling that you have inside the shuttle?
Well, my first shuttle flight was the 23rd shuttle flight overall in the program, and I had listened very, very carefully to each of the 22 crews that flew ahead of me, and took very detailed notes of what they experienced and saw and did, And I thought that I had a pretty good understanding of what launch was going to be like. And I would daydream about it when I was, you know, lifting weights in the gym or whatever it was I was doing, and that afforded me the chance to daydream. And yet, I can vividly recall about 15 seconds after liftoff, thinking to myself, Ross, what are you doing here? I mean, it was a very dynamic, very exciting ride. There was a lot of noise and vibration, and the wind on the outside of the orbiter was just screeching by us. It felt like the tiles are going to be ripped off the surface of the orbiter as we went through the lower reaches of the atmosphere. It was a very dynamic event. And so it really caught my attention, and it was much more than what I expected.
Much more of a wild ride than you expected.
Yeah, but I went back for six more, so I guess it didn't scare me too bad.
It must be like your first ride on a roller coaster. You want to go back again.
Yeah, you run around to the end of the line and get back on it again.
Each of your missions had an important role in NASA's space program, and they're all very interesting. But I think the most intriguing is STS-74, your mission to the Russian Mir space station. I understand that the space station was very small and crowded and old, and I guess that maybe the proper term is in need of repair. I'd like to hear your explanation of your mission there, a very different mission than most astronauts have had.
Right. Well, it was one of the very first times that a crew launching from the ground, other than the Soviets going to their space station and our Skylab experience, in the shuttle era, was one of the very first times that a space shuttle was going to visit another inhabited volume in space. And so it was a really unique experience. Fortunately, we had a chance to do some minimal training with the two Russians and the German crew members that were on board. But we'd been told a lot of wives' tales. We'd been told to expect a lot of debris and a foul smell when we opened up the hatch to get into the Mir station. And there was a lot of things that we had been told to expect. Fortunately, those were basically all wrong. There was no noticeable difference in the odor when we went from our vehicle into the Mir station. There certainly was a cramped space, but actually there was more volume to move around in by far than what there was in the shuttle itself. So that was a nice surprise to have additional volumes to move around in and new volumes you'd never been in before. But it was pretty cluttered. Long runs of between the various different volumes of the Mir station, there were a lot of bags of equipment tied off along the corridors, and it almost felt like you were a seal going through a kelp bed with all the things that you had to maneuver around and through to get from place to place.
Did the Russians have a resupply ship like Progress at the time that would take garbage from the space station and have it burn up in the atmosphere upon reentry?
Yeah, well, they did, but the problem was a lot of the things that they wanted to keep on the station, they had to find a place to store them, and they quickly ran out of closet space, like most people do after they've been living in a house for a number of years. A lot of it was spare parts, a lot of it was experiments that they may want to conduct again sometime later, or was parts for their spacesuits that, the expendables like the carbon dioxide removal systems or new batteries or something like that. So there was a lot of equipment that they wanted to keep around. There wasn't a whole lot of stuff that was really just plain old trash that could be discarded. But they literally did run out of places to store things. They opened up panels and stored things where they weren't planning to put things earlier, but they just ran out of those open or free volumes that they could store things in. Like most people should, they should plan more closet space in their houses when they build them.
STS-27 was a Department of Defense classified mission. Now that the Cold War is over, are you able to discuss any of that mission with the public?
No, I'm not. In fact, I had done a Freedom of Information request to several of the federal agencies, seeing if we could release more of the information about the mission. And the answer came back no. And in fact, there have been some crews who have been contacted by various different federal agencies and have been told that their missions are no longer classified, but that is not the case for our mission.
Very interesting. Yeah, still, after all these years.
Yeah, it was 1988 that mission flew, so it's a long time ago.
A long time after the fall of the Soviet Union, too, yes.
Right.
You've performed 9 spacewalks. What's it like to walk in space?
It's a real sensation of freedom and exhilaration. To get outside of the confines of the relatively small living volume of the space shuttle or the space station, and to be literally out there in the universe, inside your own little spacecraft, which is your spacesuit, incredible experience. And being able to just literally turn your body around from having a whole face full of Earth to directing it in the opposite direction to having a whole face full of the universe is an incredible experience, and one that never got to be something that was boring. Unfortunately, when you're outside, you're very busy. You're on a clock. You've got a lot of tasks to do, and every minute is accounted for, basically, in the scheduling of what you're going to do. So literally, you can go around the world in 90 minutes and never have had a chance to look out and enjoy the views that that are down there below you, or obviously looking the other direction towards all of the stars and constellations out there.
Actually, that was a question I was going to ask a little bit later, is that I've heard a lot of astronauts tell me about looking through the gondola on the space station when they've had a little bit of time. And I've always wondered what it looked like. I'm an amateur astronomer, and I think all my astronomy friends would like to know the difference between looking back out at the universe without any atmosphere.
Well, it's not a whole lot different than being out in a nice clear mountain environment or something where you have relatively thin air, not a whole lot of humidity, and you know, away from city lights and things like that. You know, a nice clear night out when I was out at Edwards Air Force Base, we used to go out as a family and lay down on the ground on blankets and watch for meteorites and just enjoy the star show out there, which is pretty awesome. It was at an altitude of 2,300 feet and very dry, so and, you know, you get out there in the desert away from city lights, it's spectacular.
You can see the Milky Way galaxy, and it's very close.
You can just see a lot more stars, and it makes it harder, quite frankly, in some ways, to pick out major navigational stars or constellations, because there are so many other stars that kind of hide the easy ones to pick out when you're in a city light configuration and have just the very brightest of stars, which we use for navigational purposes, more evident under those conditions. The neat thing is that you do see not only the stars that we get to see here in the northern hemisphere, but also the stars that people in the southern hemisphere get to see as well. So we got to see the Southern Cross and things like that. So it's pretty spectacular, there's no doubt about it.
And the aurora, I'm sure, that must be quite an experience.
Yes, I got to see several auroras. Our flights, most of them were not real high inclination orbits, so it wasn't always the case where we could see auroras. But on my sixth flight, after we had done our assembly work on the International Space Station that started that assembly, in fact, we were flying over Canada at night, and we were actually flying through an aurora, and it was just an incredible experience. It was a very faint aurora. It was whitish. It almost felt like you had some very sheer curtains that were out there in the payload bay, just kind of rippling in a non-existent wind. But we noticed it. We turned down all of our lights in the cabin so that we could look through the glass without having the reflection of the lights on the glass. And all of us on the crew just kind of sat there and just oohed and aahed for about 10, 15 minutes as we crossed over basically the entirety of Canada and were in the aurora almost throughout the entire time frame.
That must have been quite an experience. I've seen auroras from the Earth, but to fly through one in space must have been quite an experience.
Yeah. It really was.
You've flown several missions and spacewalks and done hazardous things. At any time did you feel that your life was in danger as an astronaut?
Probably the only time on orbit that I felt that way. During ascent, you really feel like you're hanging on for a ride and you hope that everything works well. And it's an 8.5-minute ride, and it's both the longest and shortest 8.5 minutes of your life. And when you get onto orbit safely, that's when you see some of the most honest and true smiles on people's faces that you're ever going to see. But on orbit, I think the only time that I really felt some level of apprehension was on the classified military flight, STS-27, where we had seen quite a bit of debris coming off of the solid rocket boosters during ascent. And we pointed the robotic camera on the robotic arm around the side of the orbiter and looked at the belly of the orbiter, and we could see a lot of dings, a lot of damage to the surfaces of the protective tiles down there. That camera wasn't the greatest. We couldn't see really well, but we knew there was damage. And we downlinked that video to the ground, but since it was a classified mission, the video was encrypted. And our sense was that we could see more damage than what we thought the ground was able to see through their encrypted and then decrypted video that we were sending to them. So we were a little bit apprehensive during the reentry on that mission that we would survive. And in fact, when we got onto the ground and walked around the vehicle, we saw a tremendous amount of damage on the tiles. And in fact, it was the most damage done to the tiles on any mission at all, save probably the Columbia accident. And the Columbia accident really wasn't tile damage. It was damage done to the reinforced carbon-carbon on the left leading edge of the left wing. And then also, we were glad that we had survived. We also noticed that there was a complete tile that had fallen off on the right wing. And after the Columbia accident, engineers went back and reanalyzed the thermal conditions of our flight on STS-27. And they told us that we were fortunate there was a double thickness of metal right underneath where that tile fell off. Otherwise, we probably would have had a burn through and would have had the same result as the Columbia mission. Would have had our wing burn off, and the vehicle and the crew would have been lost.
So the tile had come off in a much more protected area on the shuttle.
Yeah, there was that tile happened to be right over the top of an antenna that was mounted there on the surface of the wing, and so there was a double thickness of metal right in that area. Otherwise, it most likely they thought would have burnt through.
I know that you told me that your faith is a big part of your life, and of course, your experience as an astronaut.
Yeah, it really has, Andy. I think that God was there intervening at important steps along the way, and I really think it helped me to deal with setbacks or not getting something when I tried to get it the first time in a very positive fashion. I really have felt that God has been in control and that he knows best, and that if I was trying for something and it wasn't what God thought was the best for me, then I would take a step back and wait for him to show me what he wanted me to do. So I always had my goal in mind. I always tried to do the best I could with my educational opportunities and with my work opportunities to be prepared to seize the opportunities when they presented themselves. But I always felt that I was in good hands, in God's hands, and that whatever happened would be fine, even if I didn't become an astronaut.
Well, you've certainly had a wonderful career as an astronaut, and we hope that the next generation will have the same opportunity that you've had in spaceflight. What advice would you give young people that would like to pursue a career to become an astronaut?
Well, I don't know if you know it or not, but I have just recently published my second book, which is a children's version of the original. And in that, I really encourage young people to think about what their God-given talents, likes, and dislikes are. And to try to figure out how to use those in their adult life. And then to set goals for themselves, to study hard, to work hard, and to not give up too easily in pursuing those goals. And that outline applies if they want to be a doctor or a business person or a teacher or an astronaut or whatever. It all takes the same types of attributes. The thing that is different is each individual person is unique. They have a unique blend and combination of likes and dislikes and talents and capabilities. And they're all not all cut out of the same cloth, so they're not all meant to be doing the same thing. Fortunately, we need all those different types of of well-educated people out in the world to do all the different types of tasks that are out there. And so I would tell any young person that they need to get a great education. They need to set their life's goals so that they are in tune with their personal capabilities and likes and dislikes and talents, and to take a great opportunity of getting the outstanding education in our country. They're provided to all of us to have, and to take any job you have and to work at it and to learn as much you can and as do as well as you can. Some of the jobs I had directly out of college weren't the jobs that I thought were going to take me directly to where I wanted to be in terms of getting involved in our country's space program and eventually to become an astronaut. But I tried to do the very best at one of each of those jobs, and I tried to learn as much as I could from each of them. And in so doing, I was recognized by my managers as somebody that was willing to work hard and to put in the hours to get the job done. And that opened doors of opportunity to me, which eventually did lead to where I got a chance to successfully apply to the astronaut program on the second attempt, not the first one. And all that worked, and even after I got into the astronaut office, I worked hard. I studied hard. I took the opportunity to put in the extra effort that would help me to get the opportunities to eventually get assigned to crews, and that all worked out just fine for me. And it can for other people, too. I think most people who you would consider to be successful, if you ask them what they would suggest, would tell young people basically the same thing. If the goals that you have for yourself are in tune with your God-given talents and capabilities, then you're probably going to be very successful in that job or some job similar to what your goals are. And that makes life a lot of fun because you never feel like you're working to make a living for yourself. You feel like you're having fun. And that was what I found in my career, was that I felt like I worked hard, but I never felt like I was working.
If you would like to know more about Dr. Ross and his books, he has a website.
Yes, and thank you for asking. It is www.jerrylross.com, JerryLRoss.com. And there's a tab in there that's K through 12 that has teachers' lesson plans incorporated into it that teachers can use in conjunction with the book in the classroom, or homeschoolers could use for educational purposes. But the very final chapter or very final section of the book is one where I address directly to young people and challenging them to figure out what their life's goals are going to be, and then to, again, study hard, work hard, and don't give up too easily.
Dr. Ross, thanks for this very enjoyable interview.
Andy, it's been a pleasure to talk to you, and I hope to see you again sometime down in Florida or elsewhere. Thanks.
Yes, hope to see you soon. Thanks again.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Cosmic Perspective is an Andy Panero's production. Thanks for listening to this 365 Days of Astronomy podcast.